We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at the lunchtime campus Bible study, where it was delivered for university students.
'63, and unlike most of you, I was alive and conscious. Not all, but most. And conscious enough to actually remember it happening, that a huge crowd gathered together in Washington, and a man spoke in what is arguably one of the greatest addresses ever given. Certainly one of the, it's got to be in the top 10 in the history of the 20th century, and I think you can argue that it is the top one, although some of the Churchillian ones were really great, and one who doesn't speak German can only wonder what Adolf was saying, but it certainly is, just in terms of rhetoric, moved multitudes. But Martin Luther King started off under the Lincoln Memorial 50 years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand, signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared by the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of captivity. But 100 years later, we must face the tragic fact that the Negro is still not free. It only goes for 2 or 3 pages. It's considerably shorter than campus Bible study will be today, which we don't know whether that will be in the top 10 or not. Yes, but we have a fair idea. And there's a series of Negro rhetorical devices used throughout it, as well as a series of very clever white ones. He punctuates the address with certain words that are repeated, like now and like freedom. But the one that most people remember is when he comes in the middle of it. It's not actually the beginning, it's not actually the end, which is where you would expect it to be, but in the middle, when he says, I say to you today, my friends, that in spite of the difficulties and frustrations of the moment, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day even the state of Mississippi, a desert state sweltering in the heat of injustice and oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my 4 little children will one day live in a nation where they'll not be judged by the colour of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day the state of Alabama, whose governor's lips are presently dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, will be transformed into a situation where little black boys and little black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and little white girls and walk together as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream. It's a brilliant address for lots of reasons, not the least that, unlike I just read it there in the fairly cool language of reading, in the grammar and structure, with the cleverness of the words, the dream and the American dream, but he shouted it in front of hundreds of thousands. And it's clever because it really is the dream that all humans can share in, of peace and of brotherhood, of deliverance and of freedom. And of course, it's a dream that is delivered by the man who just a few years later was callously gunned down on the balcony of a motel in Memphis. His dream touched the dream of nearly all of us. You ever do sink to watching television sitcoms, and you ever notice the black ones, especially, say, the Cosby shows, they frequently refer to that day. It was a turning point for many people in a nation and in the world, because it's a dream of unity and peace and of harmony and of mutual helpfulness, of justice and of righteousness. And it's been caught up many times since. And the United Nations had a year of peace, but it's only expressing what other people have done. Indeed, if you ever look at the charter kind of documents of the League of Nations, it's just saying the same thing as that. Or indeed, as he rightly will pointed out, it's saying the same things that are built into the very Constitution and the declarations that came at the formation of the American nation. Combating hunger, injustice, disease, disaster. It's caught up when the rock stars of the world sang in a great one world concert to raise money for hungry people in North Africa. It's caught up in the desire that we have that the world could be ruled by consensus rather than by division. And as such, the aim of such dreams of unity and peace is that by human control we'll conquer our real enemies, disease and disaster, hunger and injustice. The wealth of the world, which is so enormous, would be distributed fairly and justly and equitably, rather than a few people getting most of it and most people getting almost none of it. Where we can live with our own environment in harmony, rather than rapaciously destroying our children's inheritance. Where humanity finally controlling themselves and controlling the world will live with such peace and happiness that the Edenic paradise will be recaptured. But how do we arrive at this? What are the means by which we can come to this ideal state? What are the means by which we can fulfill our dreams? Most people today, and have for some time now, seen the solution in a combination of political unity and technological advances. Working together, we will be able to create a better mousetrap. And so we labour. We work hard with dams and roads, with cities and farms and crops and livestock. And we work hard with economic planning and with medical engineering and in justice and jurisprudence. And we raise the unifying public relations symbols of the world, the space programs, the centre point towers, the parliament houses, the flags that we flutter, the university buildings that we build. And the universal religion of this scientific inquiry is mediated to us through the cyberspace village by the World Wide Web. And so our science programs, Nature, Scientific, American New Scientist, the Carl Sagans and the David Attenboroughs and the Harry Butlers, to put them in their continental differences. So they show us the gadgets, the cars, the computers, the medicine, the technology by which we are solving all our problems as we work together. The trouble with the idealist dream is reality. The reality of the bullets that riddled Martin Luther King's body, technologically driven. The reality of the power politics that continues to live by dividing races and nations, that is not just out there with official political personnel, but is inside the scientific enterprises and the university communities as within the faculties and departments, people rival for their scarce resources and their place in the sun, their place in the literature, their place in the pecking order. It's there in the reality that we can certainly create all kinds of things like chemical weapons and atomic weapons. And Ronald Reagan had a wonderful one where he had this Star Wars program where we could snoop down on everybody around the world, which was called the Peacemaker. See, that is the problem with the dream. It's actually a nightmare. It's a nightmare where technology increases and improves in a value vacuum, worse still, a vacuum of any virtues, where there is no right or wrong, where there is no good or bad, there is no virtue or evil, there is no God or Satan, where everyone does what is right in his own eyes. And so some make bandages and others make bombs, and some make foods while others develop toxins, and some fight for life while others wantonly will destroy life. For where everything is technologically clever, then everything is advocated and everything is developed and everything is defended, and self-centeredness is utilised and is developed fully. See, here is 1984. Here is the brave new world. The modern medical technology and armament technology and university research and cyberspace pornography, it's arrived. It's all around about us. And built into the nightmare of valueless technology is the power of the collective. One man, one woman, a weak, defenceless. Although we try and make films on the power of one, don't we? But many people in unity, in a concerted effort, in an organised program, cooperating with one another, now that is a real power. The collective lump has great power. When the Shah of Iran was overturned by the Ayatollah, it wasn't the Ayatollah. It was just the hundreds and thousands, nay, million people standing in the square all chanting together and holding up his phone. There was no way a Shah of Iran or an army could stand against the populace. It was the same thing in the Philippines when President Marcos and his well-shod wife. It was just the sheer number of people who were kneeling down in the roads in front of the troops. You can shoot just so many of your own citizens, but after a point you've got to say, this is pointless, it's easier to get rid of the Marcoses. It was the same in the end that brought the Berlin Wall down. It kept on thinking that some army would have to do it someday, sometime, but it wasn't. It was just the people had had enough. And so the empires of the world have all developed in the idea of unity. You unite your nation, and then you unite your nation to the other nations around about. Unite them economically, like Europe is trying to do now, so as to increase everybody's muscle by having one financial system that can rival the rest of the world and oppress the rest of the world if it gets half a chance as well, of course. But that doesn't matter if you're a European. Or uniting politically, or uniting militaristically, uniting to create a world order that governs everybody. But it always produces, friends, terrible tyranny. The great empires of the Greeks and of the Romans and of the Persians, or of the Ottomans, or of the Nazis, or of the Communists, or of the British, they're a nightmare for humanity. And Mr. Bush's New World Order won't be any different, of course. And you can see the importance of being able to rescue Kuwait, who's been invaded, who happened to be oil rich, and the total unimportance of rescuing Timor, who's been invaded, but is not oil rich, so it doesn't matter, at least not as far as they know. And in Australia, scorn is poured on anyone who raises fundamental questions that could possibly divide us. I don't agree with either of these people, so listen carefully to what I am saying and don't assume I'm saying something different. That is, the present reaction to Pauline Hanson or to Professor Blaney The reaction is a major demonstration of the insecurity of our nation. That's what it is. I'm not agreeing with them on what they say in the slightest. Professor Blaney, I hardly read, and the bits of Pauline Hanson I've read, I disagree with almost totally. But the reaction people had to her shows that you're not allowed to break the unity. You're not allowed to raise an alternative. You're not allowed to split the community. That is the great sin. And so, our ideals are always tarnished by our methods. We gain peace by war. We gain harmony with nature by subjugating it. We hold peace protests, which become violent, and we attend ecological meetings and employ other people to pick up the rubbish afterwards. Our dream is always a nightmare. Now, that's a fairly long and unhappy introduction to today's passage in Genesis chapter 11. But it is what Genesis 11 is about, I want to suggest to you. That is, mankind after the flood was united. There was one family that came out of the ark and worshipped God together. But the division started when Noah's drunken nakedness that Ham used to dishonour his father, and so the family was divided. The sons Ham, Shem and Japheth are now to have a different future. But chapter 11 verse 1 to 2, you see, there was a time when there was one language. Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As men moved eastward, they found the plain of Shinar and settled there. It's hard to work out how this fits in with the genealogy that we already studied on other weeks in chapter 10. Of course, in chapter 10, verse 5, you'll see people are divided from these, the maritime people spread out into their territories by their clans within their nations, each with its own language. And chapter 10, verse 20, these are the sons of Ham by their clans and languages in their territories and nations. In other words, chapter 11 is not chronologically following chapter 10. In chapter 11, it follows the genealogy story right out, so as to show how the nations have fanned out across the world, and it leaves beside the really important family that it's going to mention about Shem down to Abraham in the second half of chapter 11. But before it tells you the Abraham story, it calls back one other issue, the issue of the division that took place sometime in chapter 10, the division of the Tower of Babel. But that's what chapter 11 tells us. It tells us of their final splitting, of this unity being destroyed. Now, how did it come about? Well, they moved to Shinar, which is Babylonia, the plain of Shinar, where Babylon was. And they decide to build, and what they build there in verse 4 is a city with a tower in it. And they build it, verse 3, out of bricks and tar, because there's no stone there, and so you can't build it from stone. You have to make mud bricks if you're going to build in that part of the world. That is, the necessity led to technology, as is the case throughout history, and by their technology they then build a city with this tower in it. It's interesting, really, that we are now getting much closer to what we know historically, because it is true. Babylonia is not an area where there are stones in which to build, and so it's not like Egypt where you can be having the Great Pyramids. They don't have anything that can do anything like that for you, so you do have to build out of bricks and tar is exactly how they did build. And it's also true that they were great builders of towers, and Babylon had a history of building towers as places of worship and places of national privilege and drawing attention and the like. But the essence of the narrative is really the purpose of verse 4. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves and not be scattered over the face of the whole earth." What are they trying to do? They're trying to reach to the heavens. The name Babylon means the gate of the gods. That's what it means. They're trying to build their way to heaven. And why are they doing it? So as to make a name for themselves, so that they will brook no rival. So who is there that is their rival? but God. After all, it's humanity as a whole. And their aim is so that they wouldn't be scattered. And why don't they wish to be scattered? But because of the weakness and vulnerability that you come as you are scattered. But they were building a unifying symbol for humanity, which was to give people a place in the gods. It was to give people the reputation as the rulers, as those in control on the earth. Here is Noah's family playing Adam and Eve. You don't play Adam and Eve by taking your clothes off and hiding in the fig bushes. You play Adam and Eve when you try to become God, when you try to invade heaven, when you try to establish yourself as the ruler of the world. That is when you play Adam and Eve, and that's what they were doing again. And like all nightmares, it's half true. A nightmare that has no semblance to truth is a nightmare I've never had. There's always truth caught up in it. There's always bits and pieces that, and the closer it is to the truth, the more terrifying I find them. Weird, grovelly monsters, they don't do very much to me, but that nightmare that I have where I run over a little child in a pedestrian crossing, you know, that one really, that disturbs me for the rest of the night. It's just so close to what could be true. It could happen to any one of us with a kid running out on a road any time, couldn't it? And so the ones that are true, the truer they are, the worse they are, and this is a dreadful nightmare because it's really partly true. So the consequence of man's thrust for divinity is frustration, because God thwarted the plan by dividing them. He did that because they were successful in part. Look at verse 5. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower the men were building, and the Lord said, if as one people speaking the same language they've begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come, let's go down and confuse their languages so that they will not understand each other. You see, humans are in the image of God. Humanity as a whole is in the image of God. Humanity was placed by God in his image to rule the world. Therefore, if humanity gets its act together, humanity can rule the world. But that's not all. Because we are now the rebel humans. We are now ruling the world not in submission to God, but in defiance and rebellion against God. And so God frustrates humanity's ability to do it. How? By confusing the language. Because language is the way in which not only we think, but we communicate. Not only we communicate, but we think. Division in language is division amongst people. And so the failure comes of the dream, and it now turns into the nightmare that we have. I clicked out some time ago, 1991, an article out of the Bulletin about Kuwait and the Arabs. Consider the word hello. The Iraqis, who speak English, use it when they mean goodbye. Or so it seems. It was good to see you. Hello. Or, you must leave. That's final. Hello. Foreign diplomats and journalists in Baghdad find this amusing. Perhaps one suggests it's not surprising Saddam hasn't gotten the message to pull out of Kuwait. We say goodbye, and he says hello. Except the Iraqis are, in fact, are saying Allah wa salam in local dialect. It means welcome, whether you are coming or whether you're going. So American visitors blithely say goodbye, hear hello and make jokes, while the Iraqis are saying welcome and wonder what the foreigners are sniggering about. Differences in language, rhetoric, religion, logic, notions of truth and freedom, honour, trust, family, friendship, hospitality, all account for the misunderstandings that persist between the Arabs and the West. Pretty hard to get on with people when you can't even work out what hello means. But it's been like that in lots of ways. One history of the Aboriginal people that I read indicated a problem that I only know from this book. I don't know it's true, but I know it's enough from several books. But when the English landed on our shores, They did two things. They smiled and they looked the Aborigines in the eye. Well, the smiling didn't matter too much, although if there'd been Red Indians it would have, because Red Indians, some tribes are Red Indians, know in America that anybody who smiles at them is trying to steal from them and trick them, and that just shows that those Red Indian tribes are smarter than us, because have you ever seen a politician who doesn't smile, or a used car salesman, or a real estate agent? I mean, pretty sensible to actually not trust anybody who smiles. I'll try not to at this moment, I can see who you are. But the eye contact one, no. These are the Aboriginal cultures were that people who stare you in the eye are putting the evil spirit on you, trying to take your soul out of you, trying to actually influence and affect you and overwhelm you. The right way of dealing with somebody is to look away from them. But of course, to the English, anybody who looks away from you and doesn't look you in the eye, they're shifty, they're not trustworthy. You can't trust someone who can't stare you in the eye. What chance did we have of ever communicating? If I look you in the eye, I'm trying to overwhelm you, which they were. If I don't look you in the eye, I'm shifty. The communication between people has been profoundly and severely and completely ruptured. To say nothing, of course, of men coming from Mars and women from Venus. And so God confuses their language and scatters them from there over the earth. They stop building the city and they're confused in their language and they're scattered forever. Now the Bible's understanding of Genesis 11, 1-9 is consistent, but it's not actually quoted. It's alluded to whenever the word Babylon is mentioned, because Babylon becomes the overweening pride of empire. Babylon is the great rival god, the attempt to make humanity into God. And you see right up the end of the book of Revelation about Babylon, the great harlot, falling and so forth. But there are indications and allusions throughout. Firstly, divisions. Mankind is always seen as divided, and divided by God himself. So, for example, Deuteronomy 32, when the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, when he divided all mankind, he set up boundaries for the peoples in according to the numbers of the sons of Israel. That is, God has divided humanity. Or in Acts 17, when Paul is on the hill at Athens, from one man he made every nation of men that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he determined the time set for them and the exact places where they should live. God did this so that men would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he's not far from each one of us. Not a text that's well known, but an important part of biblical understanding. God divided us so that we would seek for him. You see, it's the reverse of the Tower of Babel, because in our unity we were seeking to rival God. God didn't want us to rival him, so he divided us, scattered us about in all our different nationalities and racial groupings, so that we would be frustrated, so that we would not be able to live by ourselves as God without him. And so that we would seek and search after him, or Romans chapter 8. The creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. This one's not dealing with humans being divided necessarily, but it's the same principle, that God has brought his judgment on the world to make the world unworkable for us, so that we would long for the better world, for things being put right. Part of God's frustration of the world is that it stops us destroying the world because we're incompetent, but it really is so that we will look to God. When you come to the four horsemen of the apocalypse in Revelation chapter 6, it's all about God sending out plague and war and disease. And why? Well, it's because they are the trumpet warnings from God that everything is not right with the world. See, we have in our mentality in westernized Christianity a view which is quite different to the Bible. A view which says everything that happens that's right is God's work, and everything that happens that is wrong is the devil's work. And then we define right as peaceful, comfortable, wealthy, just, nice and happy, and wrong as being sick, losing your job, being hungry, being scattered. So that's not how the Bible sees it. God creates, the Bible says, both wealth and woe. He has created not only the ability to build the Tower of Babel, but also the inability to finish it. He has created within us the divisions that we have and the misunderstandings and the miscommunications of our different cultures. Because we are so close to being God that we will not turn to the true and living God if we're able to live as God has created us to live, as the rulers of the world. And so he has frustrated our very attempts. And therefore divisions will always be amongst us. There will always be wars and rumours of wars. Till the Christ returns, there will always be wars and rumours of wars. There are these wonderful optimistic humanists who think by establishing the League of Nations in the 1920s that they would resolve the problems of the wars that created just as many. Who think that by the creation of the United Nations we have somehow resolved the problems. Between 1945 and 1965 there were 50 major international wars. We have not stopped wars. We have not come close to stopping wars. This is a talk I can give over and over every year. All I've got to do is look up the daily newspaper and see which country to put in this time. But it never changes. There's always a country at war somewhere. It is the character of it. People are divided. We thought we could have a thing called Rwanda. We forgot the fact that people actually live in tribes, not in nations, but European nations in Africa. And so we've continued this civil war, which is really a tribal war, which is really appalling. Divisions are always with us. Second thing that will always be with us is arrogance. Our attempt to rule the world without God, to be immortal, will continue till Christ. We keep aiming by the use of unity and technology to build our way to heaven. Nebuchadnezzar. That's what he did in Daniel chapter 3. He builds a great statue. And whenever the music played, all the peoples, nations and tongues of the world will fall down and worship him. Adolf Hitler understood him. In fact, big... some religious freedom, provided they don't meet. Provided they don't preach. Provided they don't tell anybody about their religion. Provided they don't baptise anybody into another religion. Because... you've got to say, the Malayans have the same problem. Those of you who come from Malaysia and may have not wished me to point it out to the others, but let me educate the rest. So, you know, Malayans have to be Muslims, don't they? And if our non-Malayan friends or our Malaysian friends care to evangelise them and call upon the Malayan to stop being a Muslim, become a Christian, then both the Malayan who becomes a Christian and the other Christian who tries to persuade them to become a Christian are likely for jail. We've got to unite, and religion is used to unite people. And so you have the present intolerance of minority views, especially views that will divide. And so there are those desperate attempts. Esperanto. Anybody speak Esperanto here? Exactly. Well, it is the one world language that was constructed. I don't even know when it was constructed. Someone might have to tell me when it was constructed, but I think it was a late 19th, early 20th century attempt to create the language that we would teach everybody, and so everybody could speak this one language, just like the medieval church tried to impose Latin on everybody so that everybody would think the same. And so we really are not doing anything different, are we? You must be united. You cannot stand out as different. Friends, it's not all that different here in the university, is it? In the land of great freedom and intellectual privilege, where you can say anything, where you're allowed to say anything, you're not really, are you? You run up your protests in the class about being a Christian, in your general studies classes, in the tutorials, in the arts faculties, etc. You just run up the little protest and say, but by the way, I'm a Christian, I believe. And you'll see how hard it is to actually be free in this, the Great Hall of Freedom. Two publications in Australia won the battle against censorship in the 1960s. They were Honiswar and Tharunka. Honiswar, the publication of the students Sydney University, not the Student Representative Council as it's called over there, Tharunka, the publication here on this campus. And they took on the national, in fact, in the end they took on London in the international scene to break censorship so that you could say anything, doesn't matter how blasphemous, doesn't matter how vulgar, doesn't matter how obscene, that you could say exactly what you wanted to say. Both publications in the 1990s have published articles calling upon the local student guild and the student representative council to ban Christians from the campus. The very tools by which liberation for expression came in one generation are the same tools that call for control and thought control in another generation. We cannot have alternative views. I'm glad to say they failed, of course. Yet the dream is right. According to the Bible, it's right. Humanity is like God, and humans will rule the world in the city of God, in heaven itself. It's the city that Abraham was longing to see. By faith he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations, whose architect and builder is God. There is a city of God, and there is a city of God that from way back in the times of Abraham we've been looking, but it's God's city, not our city. It's not built from earth up to heaven, it actually comes from heaven down to earth. And it comes down in the person of Jesus, given by God to create peace and unity between mankind and God. It was commenced when the man was raised to heaven, the last Adam, Jesus, who poured out his spirit on the day of Pentecost, so that all languages heard the same message in God's temple. For when they preached of Jesus as the Christ, risen from the dead, establishing the new kingdom, then from all kinds of languages over the Middle East, they heard the same message. The Tower of Babel had been reversed. All this has enormous implications for us. Here are four quick ones. One, for technology. We are able, but frustrated by society's sinfulness and by God. Technology is not bad, but is always used badly. It will be used to aggrandize humans and to promote an idealized unity. Secondly, for society. Society is always going to be divided. Don't be alarmed. Don't expect more than you'll get. I mean, it's been funny, tragic funny, to see the Balkans in the last little while, because the very fights that kicked off World War I have now gone the full circle and they're back again. It was all kicked off with the fight between Croatians and Serbs in the first place. And here we are at the end of the century in the same place we were when we started the century. It hasn't actually changed. Eastern Europe fighting is still the same deal. Nationalism, internationalism will not work without the changed hearts of humans. And that is not going to work without the gospel conquering everybody. Divisions will incapacitate us, and they should. Because out of our incapacity, some may seek to search for God to find the answer. Thirdly, it has implications for our understanding. Understanding the Tower of Babel will give you an understanding of realistic idealism. See, realists without any ideals are cynics and skeptics, and the most dangerous of people. Idealists without realism are gullible fools, and when placed in power, the most dangerous of people also. I don't know which is worse. That's why I call them both the most dangerous of people. But Christians are idealists who are realists at the same time. Idealists because the Garden of Eden, because of heaven, because of God. We know the good that we want. What our friend Martin Luther King said, well, it was governed by his Christian idealism. He knew what was the good. And what he called the good, everybody can recognize as the good. It's not just his values, it's virtues. Christians are idealists, but we're realists. We know that it will not come by the means of unity. It will not come by the means of technology. It will not come by the education. It will come by the grace of God in the gospel of Jesus. That is the only way it comes. So what do we do now? Nothing? No, technology is a good thing. And unity is not a bad thing. They're good things. We'll be for them. They're just limited. you always are putting on band-aids. But there's nothing wrong with band-aids, especially if you've got shares in Johnson's. There's nothing wrong with band-aids themselves. So people keep on saying, well, look, going out and helping this problem, helping that problem, it's just putting band-aids on the problem. What we need is a revolution. Revolution is just another band-aid. May not be as good as the one that you're putting on. For whatever band-aid you put on, they'll die sooner or later anyway. But in the meantime, you may as well stop the bleeding. Nothing wrong with stopping the bleeding, even though they're going to die. But technology is good, it's just limited. And technology is good, but it can be used for bad when by it we think we're going to unite humanity in the grand quest of becoming God. Like the end of that last sentence or so of that book by the Short History of Time. It's a wonderful thing. When we get the unified theory, then we will know the mind of God. Then we will have achieved. You know that's not going to work. His ideals are right. He's heavily influenced by Christianity. But his understanding has failed. He hasn't read the Tower of Babel and understood what it's about. So recognise the limits, recognise the evil motives, but take action. Now, of course, the greatest action of all is to proclaim Christ. For when Christ comes, he brings us peace, not only with God, but with ourselves. And not only with God and with ourselves, but with each other. And when he returns, then the city of God will be made clear and apparent for everybody. The city that is not built by humans up into the heavens, but built by God and brought down to humans. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank and praise you for your Son and his death and resurrection, that in him we may share in being your children, citizens of your city, dwellers in heaven, rulers of the universe with you. Pray, Father, you forgive us for our folly in wanting those things which are right, but wanting them without you, wanting them in defiance of you, wanting them as expressions of our very rebellion against you. Help us, Father, to be loyal and faithful citizens of our country. Help us to share in the technology and to live at unity and peace with people as much as we are able. But help us, Father, to seek and to know that peace which the world does not understand, that unity which the world cannot deliver, that unity that comes through the death and resurrection of your own Son. And we pray in his name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.